Throughout the 1980s, a strange phenomenon was sweeping North America.
They were in a panic. And like people in a panic, they want solutions.
Allegations of underground satanic cults, torturing and terrorizing children. The thing is, there were no satanic cults preying on children. And nearly 30 years later, the people touched by it all are still picking up the pieces.
This isn't a work of fiction. This is a work of history.
Satanic Panic, available now.
This is a CBC podcast.
Welcome to Ideas. I'm Nala Ayed.
Well, the difference between global and international is that many, many languages are international. And what international means is a language that is used across more than one country. So you think about Arabic or think of French even, or even German. There's a lot of languages that are spoken in more than one country, and that makes them international.
In 400 years, English went from being a small language spoken in the British Isles to becoming the most dominant language in the world. It's not merely an international language. It's global.
English is a global language. It's a good term to use precisely because it means something different than international. But we shouldn't think that English is spoken by the majority of people in the world. English is still, paradoxically, a minority language, if that makes any sense, meaning that most people in the world don't speak English. Global just means it is found and used far more widely than any other language.
Okay, so you guys went, and how far? So 2.5 hours.
It's 2.5 hours.
English is present all over the world as an enduring legacy of colonialism.
No, Gadi, nothing. It was just us.
But it's also a global language of commerce and culture, overtaking local languages and pushing them aside.
They were like Janakpuri, Rampuri, something like that. I'm like, what is this?
So many different puris.
Some think of English as a gift. Others call it a bully, a loudmouth, a thief. But some argue there's a need to rethink English and see it as a language with multiple versions standing on equal footing.
Yeah, so my name is Mario Saraceni. I'm a reader in English language and linguistics at the University of Portsmouth in the UK.
And can you just tell me the term reader, which is not a common term that we use here?
Ideas producer Nahid Mustafa asks the question, English, friend or frenemy?
Yeah, reader actually is the same as associate professor. It's equivalent to that. In fact, we are in the process of changing reader to that exactly for the reason that you've mentioned, because people around the world are not necessarily familiar with the term. So it means associate professor.
I suppose that sort of widespread aspect of English, I don't know if widespreadedness is a word, but the widespread aspect of English, brings about that question whether English is a gift or whether English is a monster. Does it have to be either of those things?
Well, yes, that's a really good question. I mean, a lot of people feel very negative about the presence of English in its global context. And they tend to think of it as a monster, as a language that kills other languages and kills other cultures and kind of colonizes it, you know, as a continuation of imperialism and so on and so forth. Other people see it as a gift, you know, as something that gives opportunities, that enhances careers, makes communication, international communication easier, and so on. And so, I mean, the fact is that both these aspects are true, but they're not mutually exclusive in the sense that, you know, when we're talking about a global language, in fact, when we talk about language in general, we're talking about something extremely complex.
So we'll get into some of those complexities in a bit, but I want to sort of clarify a couple of terms before we go on further. Yeah. Is the term English-speaking world at all a useful term?
I don't like it particularly because it suggests that whatever we refer to when we say world, you know, you could say English-speaking country or English-speaking world or English-speaking region or whatever. But what that tends to mean is that that world or that part of the world speaks English. And that's simply not true, because English, in the vast majority of cases, English exists and is used in conjunction and alongside other languages. So a lot of people in the world, probably the majority of people in the world, are multilingual. So they speak more than one language. Very often they speak three, four languages, and English is one of them. And sometimes English, in fact, very often English is not, it does not feature at all. So when we say English-speaking world or English-speaking anything, it's misleading, because it kind of erases the presence and the importance of other languages that coexist with English.
Another term, dialect. You and I had a conversation about this before we did this interview, and you had I thought of it as a kind of a pithy description of what a dialect is.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, first of all, the word dialect is slightly problematic, because dialect tends to come with negative connotations. When people think of a dialect, they tend to think of some sort of substandard form of a language. So when somebody says this is a dialect of English or a dialect of German or a dialect of any other language, the assumption is that it's a non-standard version of that language. Whereas in sociolinguistics, which is my area, my academic area, we consider dialects as varieties. It just, this is a form of a language, this is another form of a language, and this is another one. And so differences aren't good or bad, they're just differences. And so we tend to prefer the term variety rather than dialect to avoid the negative connotation. But the other interesting thing about dialect is that a question that often, you know, we don't think of is what really is the difference between a language and a dialect? You know, who decides whether one form of a language is a dialect and another form of a language is the language, so to speak? And that ultimately is a matter of power, and you know, a group of people that holds more power in a society, or a community of people that holds more power in a society, their language or their version of the language is likely to be the standard and therefore the language, whereas everything else would be considered a dialect. And so it's very political and is very much related to power. And I mean, I can go on about this for quite a bit, but just interesting examples of that, for example, is if you consider languages like Serbian and Croatian in former Yugoslavia, they're considered two different languages. When Yugoslavia was a country, that language was called Serbo-Croat. And in effect, I mean, so the question is, are they two different languages or not? They're mutually intelligible. They're written in different scripts. And it's linguistically speaking, it's virtually impossible to resolve that question. The question is entirely political, meaning that when Yugoslavia was a country, it was one language. Now that it's split into different countries, these are separate languages. But it has very little to do or nothing to do with linguistic features, and everything to do with politics and power.
And so how easy is that to say? I mean, nobody wants to hear that the language of their political opponents or the language of their, even in some cases, the language of their enemy is the same as their own language. Do you find that there's a sort of a rift in how we talk about this just popularly versus how it's spoken about academically?
Yeah, I think so, yes. But the thing is that what academia does or should do is observe the world, essentially, and understand it and make sense of it. And so these things that we're talking about here, it's not that the layperson has a distorted view of language, etc. The layperson has a view of language and academia understands it, tries to understand it. So, for example, you could have two communities, two societies speaking very, very similar languages from a purely linguistic point of view. But there might be one or two, you know, fairly insignificant differences. But those differences are symbolically extremely important because they actually mark differences and allow this community to say, we speak this language, and the other community to say, we speak this other language. This is particularly useful in inverted commas when the two languages are, or the two versions of the same language, whatever we want to call them, are written in different scripts, because the script allows you to say, look, this is a different language. And so, and those views about language are extremely important, you know, and ultimately it's what counts, because linguists could say whatever they want to say, but what counts is what real people, it's not that we're not real people, you know, what do we, you know, lay people, their views of language and what language matters or how it matters to them and what it means, it's extremely important. So sometimes you have the pronunciation of a word that may be different across a border, and that's enough to say we speak this and you speak that. You know, this is what happens, for example, across the border between Thailand and Laos. You know, the language spoken on either side of the border is virtually the same, but it takes a tiny difference to allow the two nations to say this is Lao and the other side this is Thai. And this is perfectly normal and happens everywhere in the world.
Is there an example of where the opposite has happened, where two languages historically considered different languages by the people that speak them suddenly become a single language?
Well, I think that what comes to my mind is Arabic, because Arabic is interesting, because Arabic is very, very interesting, because you have a language that is formally spoken in a lot of countries in North Africa and the Middle East, right? In actual fact, a lot of people, you know, sort of on the ground, in the streets, at home, etc., speak their own very local variety, which sometimes is, you know, it's hardly intelligible to somebody from another country. But I think what matters is the sense of broader community and identity that Arabic, as in terms of modern standard Arabic, allows these societies to have. So, you know, what you have is languages that are used on a daily basis, and they may be, you know, Darija in Algeria or Morocco, and, you know, other local varieties of Arabic. And then you have this kind of super common language, which is modern standard Arabic, which has a strong identity, strong religion function that puts everybody together in ways which are pretty much the opposite of what I was talking about 5 minutes ago. So I think this answers your question, doesn't it? This is an example of yeah, the opposite of that kind of thing where one little difference marks a whole, you know, distinctiveness between two languages. This is the other way around.
Oh, bien expansé. Mm-hmm.
You like this?
Wow. Maybe only cooks the tinola.
Tinola mongo.
I think with English, what you get is that the different varieties of English that exist around the world are different. And they sound different and they look different in a way. You know, the vocabulary, the words differ to some extent. Accents are the most obviously different aspects of the, you know, different versions of English.
Oh, that's Loco's favorite.
Yeah, that's Loco's favorite. Fried egg.
You don't want Omar,
egg.
With
rice.
That's not.
But I think that those differences aren't, on the whole, they're not as marked as they would be, that they would, you know, make mutual intelligibility a problem.
I don't want to cook that inside the house. It will stink.
It smell.
But Omar, did
even
you try
to eat that?
No.
It sticks in the clothes.
If you imagine all varieties of English on a Venn diagram, if that makes any sense. If you can visualize that, every variety of English is a circle. So you have American English, you have Nigerian English, British English, Canadian English, and so on and so forth, right? Indian English. And each one of them is a circle. If you represent this thing diagrammatically, what you would get is all these circles overlapping by 90%. So there's a middle part that is the same, right? And that is your super English. And then the bits that stick out, that don't overlap, these are the distinctive features of all these varieties of English. But those distinctive features are not, you know, substantial enough to impede intelligibility. So you know, with modern standard Arabic, you have an actual formal, you know, version of the language. With English, you don't quite have that. You know, with English, you know, you have standard British English, you have standard American English, you have dictionaries and grammar books that sort of, you know, codify these varieties of English. But there isn't one kind of master standard English that exists in a dictionary or in a grammar book or anything like that. And so it's more to do with the actual use of the language and which can be, as I say, represented diagrammatically in this kind of mega Venn diagram. I don't know if that makes sense.
It does make sense. But the question that I have is about that 90% overlap, the sort of the fight about that 90%, because if that 90% is codified and that 90% is a standard English, then the question then about power and who gets to decide and who is kind of held to be the originator, those questions then linger and persist, no?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, when people think of standard English around the world, they tend to think of one or two varieties, you know, and these are British English and sometimes American English. And so these two varieties are the most powerful ones historically for very clear historical reasons. And so they tend to determine a lot of that 90%. So that's true. And that is... that's just a fact, you know. And I don't think that there is something that we can argue very much against. It's the way it is. It's true that the oldest and most powerful varieties of the language and the very reason why the language has spread around the world so much has to do with power, once again, their empire. And so the logical consequence of that is that that famous 90% is not equally shared. That's the way it is. Yeah, it's true.
In a lot of places, there's an effort which is connected to politics and cultural protectionism in some sense, where there's a real effort to keep English at bay. Keep English from quote unquote polluting local languages. And so everything gets translated into a local language, even words like computer or phone. As a person who studies language and sort of the interplay of languages, how do you think about this effort when you see this sort of drive to keep language so-called free or original or authentic?
I can see the motive behind it, and I can understand why in some places these efforts are in place. But these efforts aren't successful because what they try to do, they try and legislate against particular language use. And that's just it's not possible. People use language, as a matter of life, you know. And language, you know, I think one of the problems is that we tend to consider languages as objects, almost like as concrete objects. So this is mine, this is yours. So if I am French and I'm not using French, you know, it's because I'm using the word French because this particular legislation exists in France, but in other places in the world as well. So, you know, if I'm French, I have to own this particular object called the French language, and I'm not really supposed to be using this other object, which is called the English language, because it belongs to other people and does not belong to me. It's not part of my identity and so on. So we tend to see languages in that way. And I think that's part of the problem. Whereas if we consider language in a much more fluid manner, and it's something that is integral to our life, our social practices, everything. And also, if we consider languages not necessarily as separated from one another, you know, that would be one step forward. And the idea, also something that sometimes it you know, it's a bit difficult to fully comprehend, is how much languages continue to change all the time. So it's not, they're not some kind of fixed object that you would find in the museum. It's something very much alive, to use that metaphor. And so English totally coexists with other languages, not only in France, but in many other parts of the world, and quite happily so as well. You know, people use English and people use other languages and mix the two and mix three languages together. And because that's physiologically what happens. You know, when you have a world that is mostly multilingual, these languages in multilingual places don't stay separated. They mix and they merge and they just blend. And that's what people do. So, you know, it's futile to say, to legislate against language X or language Y, because it's impossible. You know, you get, it's almost like, I don't know, just to use a silly metaphor, you know, if you have ingredients to a recipe, if you're making a cake and you mix them together, you can't separate them again. You know, so when you have a situation where a society has two languages or more than two languages, they're there, that you can't take them apart. You can't, you know, you just part of the blend. And I think this misconception is due to our, to how much we have let our minds be persuaded that monolingualism is the norm. You know, so the German people speak German and the Italian people speak Italian and the Spanish people speak Spanish and so on and so forth. But that's just a European concept that's fairly recent. You know, this idea that one nation speaks one language. In reality, in most parts of the world, people speak different languages together simultaneously, and multilingualism is the norm. Monolingualism is the exception. This is what we need to realize.
When looking at Europe and the kind of, you know, at least for Europeans, the open border policies around there, what has happened to language use? I mean, obviously there are people that speak multiple European languages because they're living in one place and maybe studying in another or working in a third. But how has this sort of mix of people moving across borders, I mean, there still seems to be a lot of pride attached to the national language in these countries.
Sure.
What have you seen as a linguist in terms of how these language, these ideas about language are shifting in a place like Europe, where people are traveling and moving and living back and forth across borders and languages?
Yeah. So, you know, in a place like Europe, what you get is that more and more increasingly people mobility is you know, it gets easier and easier. And increasingly, you get people using English as a lingua franca. So, you know, you have Europeans traveling around, moving around, working in different countries for a few years, moving somewhere else, etc. And so you have English as a lingua franca, and that is, and it's a fairly denationalized language. So when Europeans use English, they're not using the language of the British. They're using their own language, and they're using it for their own purposes. And obviously, you know, if somebody, say, somebody from Italy goes to work in Germany, or they go or they move to Portugal or whatever, they, you know, obviously they will start speaking the language of the country as well. But there's this huge role played by English as an international lingua franca. it just makes everything easier from that point of view. And you get that. And you also have national languages that are becoming lingua franca in a way. So if you go to big cities in Europe, if you go to Milan, if you go to Berlin, and if you go to places like that, what you get is German being used as a lingua franca or Italian being used as a lingua franca by the various communities that live there. And again, you got this wonderful mix between, you know, the languages that people carry with them, the local language and English all together. People don't, on the whole, people are not too worried about that. Governments now, in the last few years, at least some governments, with this rise in nationalism that we are witnessing, are beginning to express concern. Oh, you know, we should preserve national languages, etc., because they're part of the national identity, etc. But, you know, people on the ground are quite happy to be multilingual.
You're listening to Ideas. We're a podcast and a broadcast heard on CBC Radio 1 in Canada, across North America on Sirius XM, in Australia on ABC Radio National, and around the world at cbc.ca/ideas. You can find us on the CBC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Nala Ayed.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter. And for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Quid putaste de acre locunturne etiam nunc sacerdotes Vaticani?
Latin, like English, was once a global language stretching from Europe to the Middle East. Latin also pushed out local languages, but like English, was itself changed over time.
Tamen odie pochissimi sunt illi qui possunt loqui de omnibus rebus.
This constant grappling between a global language and a local one is a given. And sometimes, despite efforts to preserve and support, a local language will lose the fight.
Related to this idea of a language becoming widespread, there's also the opposite thing that happens where languages die out. Do you think we should be concerned about dying languages or languages dying out?
This is obviously a very good question, and it's a question. You know, the answer to this question I could very easily answer the way that would be considered nice and say yes, we should be concerned, and efforts to preserve these languages are great and brilliant and everything. So I agree with that.
We're calling this episode English, Friend or Frenemy.
The problem is that very often these efforts are not entirely successful. I mean, sometimes they are, sometimes a bit less. And for me, the key point is whether or not a language has an actual function in a society. It has a reason to exist, because sometimes what you get is these efforts that try and keep a language alive almost in some sort of artificial way, for reasons that are more about identity and, you know, we need this language because it's part of who we are and so on. But then, do people actually speak it, or do people really need to speak it? It's a complex question. I don't want to be dismissive about those efforts at all. I mean, so it's difficult to really come across in a way that doesn't suggest that I'm being dismissive about these efforts. But And they're also very different in different parts of the world. I mean, if you look at Welsh and Wales, I think that has been quite successful. And I think people are speaking Welsh and you know, meaningfully. So it's not some kind of symbolic. Here's the difference that I want to really try and emphasize. The difference between a symbolic revival of a language and a meaningful sort of boosting of the role and the forms of a language somewhere. You know, if it's meaningful and if it is felt meaningful by the people, by all means, these are great. I mean, I think this is fantastic that these things happen. If it's purely symbolic, if it's just, you know, let's have this language because, you know, because it's important, full stop, then, you know, I'm a little bit more skeptical.
I guess it goes back to the analogy of like artifacts or an artifact, yes, in a museum that,
exactly,
you know, I mean, it's certainly a conversation, you know, in Canada, for example, with the preservation and the teaching of Indigenous languages, or in places like, you know, northern Pakistan, where you have multiple languages that are spoken by, you know, a very small number of people. And so you have like these efforts to record music in those languages and say folk songs. And it's beautiful to listen to. But the approach, I guess part of the motivation is thinking about, did this language die out naturally, or was this language pushed out by some form of imperialism, whether it's local, it's a dominant local language. Does that make a difference, do you think, if it's something that was the consequence of a political power problem, or if it was something that just, well, you know, people started moving away and forgetting the language, and that's, which is, I guess, also political, but does that make a difference?
Exactly. I think that's true. And it's not political. You know, it's almost like everything is a matter of power and politics. Mm-hmm. But so sometimes it's very obviously so. You know, sometimes it's very obviously a matter of one language pushing out another one. And like, you know, once again, English is the best example of that. You know, if you look at the entire African continent, you can see that happening, and it's been happening a lot. You know, languages really being marginalized and dying out because of people choosing to use English instead. It's a really interesting debate. Quite famously, in the 90s, there was a scholar who Robert Phillipson, who wrote a book on linguistic imperialism. Really, really interesting, book. And a lot of the content of that book was about how English has been marginalizing or even destroying other languages. But there's an interesting response. One of the many responses to the book was from a Nigerian author who said that Nigerians are or have the intellectual capacity to make their own choices about which languages to use. And they don't need somebody to tell them, oh, you know, you poor people, you should be using Yoruba because English is bad for you and things like that. So it's very complex. And it can be patronizing to say, you should speak your language because my language, English, is imperialistic.
So Pidgin English words are actually like Yoruba words, one of the tribes in Nigeria, one of the languages of one of the tribes in Nigeria. They will say, Oya. Oya is like, come on. So it can be, Oya, let's go. Come on, let's go. Waiting. What? Waiting be this. What is this? So waiting is what? Waiting be this. What is this? Wahala. Problem. Trouble. Oh, don't give me wahala. Don't give me stress. Wahala is trouble, stress. Before, long, long time ago. Before, like long, long time ago. I dey come, I'm coming. I dey go, I'm going. No tell me, don't tell me. And no believe, I don't believe. Free me, let me be, leave me alone.
And I want to go back to this idea of multilingualism and the merging of languages, which we are now in sociolinguistics, this new term called translanguaging, which basically means the simultaneous use of different languages together, which happens a lot anyway. And to me, that is a very powerful frame. It's a very powerful way to conceptualize the fact that we're not dealing with one language or another, but we are dealing with, okay, allowing English to enter the scene, so to speak, but that doesn't necessarily mean renouncing or erasing other languages necessarily. So, you know, the two can coexist, and they do. And smaller languages do tend to die out. It's not necessarily a marker of the contemporary world either. It's something that's always happened and has happened as a result of power. That's a trait of humankind and its relationship to language.
Well, and I want to get into I want to talk about the language mixing in just a second. One of the things that, of course, comes along with this idea of power and a particular form of a language having dominance or legislation around how language can be used is this idea of purity. Language purity. And when you and I were talking in the pre-interview, I was telling you about my grandmother who spoke a rural form of the language that was my home language. And I accidentally used the term pure to refer to the form that she spoke, that it was in a sense of that I realized that it was perhaps an older form which felt like a more authentic form. And you were not happy about my use of the term pure. You kind of told me off about that. Talk to me a little bit about why that doesn't work as a term when talking about language.
Okay. Now, the reason why that doesn't work, and the reason why I wasn't happy when you used it, is that which version of the language are we talking about? Because let's take the language, the exact language that you were referring to, right? So the rural version of a language in Pakistan. Now, you can take a metaphorical photograph of a language at one particular point in time, or even a point in geography, so time and space, and say, okay, in this village, this is how they speak, okay? Fine. Now, 200 years ago, in the same village, they would speak in something different, right? Or not even 200 years ago. You don't have to go far back in history that much. In future, they'll speak it differently. So which one is the pure language? You know, this is another myth. The myth that somehow languages have an origin, you know, languages begin somewhere, and that point in time where the language begins is the purest form, and then it kind of, you know, it gets corrupted. Sometimes, you know, we tend to think of languages in that way. And it's simply not true. Languages are not born. They don't have a point of departure. And so the language that you can document in a village or anywhere in the world is the language that they speak at that particular time. You know, and even from generation to generation, even in a tiny village, you might find differences. And you will find differences. And so 25 years time, you document the language that the children of the current adults speak, and it will be different. Maybe not very different, depending on the society and how, you know, how fast, you know, things move forward, etc. But it will be different. So there isn't a version of a language that we can consider pure, because which one is it? And languages. So that's one big reason. The other reason is that languages influence each other, and so the idea of purity, it simply doesn't make sense. You know, if you look English is probably the perfect example of a language that is everything but pure. You know, it has influences, vocabulary, grammar, everything from all over the place, and it's certainly not pure. Even if you go to if you want to consider the mythical Queen's English, or King's English, maybe we should say now. It's that's not pure at all. I mean, you know, there's French in it. There's everything. There's Greek. There's Italian. There's Germanic, obviously, the Germanic root, the Viking. There's all sorts of influences in the English language, and there is no version of it that we can consider pure.
You've written about linguistic border crossings. What does that mean?
It's going back to this idea that languages don't have borders in the same way that countries have. So a country may have a border. And very, very often, let's not forget, a lot of borders in the world have been created by European empires for reasons completely other than, you know, identities or anything like that. But anyway, so languages in most cases exist and are used across borders. I mean, look, you know, go to West Africa, for example. And what's interesting to do, if you compare the political map of West Africa, like meaning the countries in West Africa, Nigeria, Ghana, and so on, and then you compare that with the linguistic map of West Africa, what you see is that there is absolutely no correspondence whatsoever between the colors that you might want to use to identify each country and the colors and the areas that you might want to use to identify the languages. They're completely there's no coincidence at all. And all those languages exist and are used totally across borders. But West Africa is an illustrative example, but it's not an exception. It's the same in lots of parts of the world as well, in Asia, South Asia. So languages are across borders.
So you live in the UK, which is also, a fairly multicultural society. Mm. What does this linguistic border crossing look like where you are?
Well, in the UK, as you say, the society is very multicultural, is very multilingual. Obviously, not uniformly so. If you go to a place like London, the big cities, Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, and so on, yeah, you have incredible degrees of multilingualism and multiculturalism. And I mean, inner London is a fantastic, in the most positive way, sense of the word, mess of cultures and languages. And you get this, what happens in a place like London, actually, speaking of, you know, border crossing in the UK, is that, you know, just to use another culinary metaphor, when you have lots of, imagine a blender, right? So you put different ingredients in a blender, right? And then you turn it on and it makes the noise and it blends everything. What happens in London linguistically is a bit like that. So you have people from the Caribbean, people from Asia, people from Africa, for example, the big, large communities. And the way that they speak English, historically, they've arrived in London in the 50s and the 60s and so on, right? And what you get is this kind of blender effect where all those versions of English, sometimes even, you know, aspects of different languages come in. And they kind of blend it together and they form something which is a lot more uniform than their original distinctiveness, if that makes any sense. So what you have is this kind of London multicultural English, which takes elements of all these different types of English that have come from former colonies and have created this wonderful blended mix. So yes, that's what you get in a place like London. And I suppose you get something similar, in large metropolitan areas around the world. But London in particular, I think, is really interesting because you have the center of empire, right? The center of the former empire, which, you know, where English has gone out from there and has come back to it in this many different forms and has re-merged into something quite different from the way that we think of it in standard English or whatever else. It's something different and diverse, but at the same time, not so diverse, if that makes any sense. If you, you know, if you, again, if you think of the blender effect, you know, you know, when you start blending, you, and you haven't quite finished, you still see the bits, but it begins to see to become one thing, you know. So that's what's happening with this kind of all these Englishes that have come back to London, so to speak, and have reformed this new thing that is London multicultural English.
So this idea of translanguaging, especially if these are languages that you live in on a regular basis,
yeah,
it deeply clashes with this idea that you've alluded to before about monolingualism being the sort of the natural state or the normal state or the neutral state,
yeah.
And of course monolingualism is also attached, you know, culturally and politically in particular ways, you know, like it. There are political actors, but also just ordinary citizens who will use that as a sign of like authentically being from somewhere,
yes,
or a pride of place. How do you, yeah, think about these two, you know, and just in terms of the UK, this is, you know, or Canada or really anywhere else, these two phenomena coexist. As a linguist, how are you thinking about the relationship between these ideas of sort of monolingualism as some sort of natural state, but then this very real reality of translanguaging?
Yeah. I think the whole monolingualism as an ideology is something that stemmed directly from the nation state ideology in Europe. Because even Europe, before the nation state became a thing, Europe was a massive language mix, and in many ways it still is. So there was this huge emphasis on one people, one language, one territory. And we're talking about, you know, sort of between the 18th and 19th century, that became very, very prevalent. It's almost like it's a political agenda. And that then became the norm. And multilingualism, the exception in that particular frame, and we're still with that in a way, you know, that idea is still with us. I mean, that particular period, you know, sort of 18th century, 19th century, is also the period of imperial expansion, European imperial expansion. That's the period that gave us racism as well. Let's not forget. That's the period that gave us scientific racism, that postulated the existence of races, and it postulated that some races were superior and some races were inferior, that justified the whole imperial project. Now, the monolingualism ideology isn't a million miles away from that either, because it says there is this people, there is this. And when, you know, people meant race as well, you know, it was all one thing. This people with these racial connotations and with this particular territory that they inhabit, and this is their language, you know, very kind of primordial, right? Very sort of, and that there's other people and they inhabit this land and they speak this language and they called this way, and, you know, and this is them and this is us, right? And this is how the world was conceptualized, and we're still, that idea is still with us, you know, it still lingers. And in fact, I mean, you know, if you look at what's happening in politics around the world in the last, you know, five, six years, etc., is being revived. You know, this all idea, this populist idea of nationalism is kind of being resurrected. It's very much based on that, and so that's, you have even in Italy now, you know, with the current government. Now, I don't want to turn this into a political debate particularly, but the kind of legislation that you were alluding to earlier is now being discussed in Italy as well. We need to protect the Italian language because too much English is bad for the Italian language, right? Because the Italians are Italian and they speak Italian and they inhabit a country called Italy, all one, right? And so you have that that contrasts like, immensely with the reality on the ground. And maybe partly this kind of nationalistic, I don't know what the word is, resurrection, maybe it's partly due to some people fearing too much mixing. I don't know.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Shan's Patois Academy, Jamaican Patois Simplified. So Jamaican Patois is made up of many different languages. However, English has the most influence. Let's look at some words. So first rule, English words ending with ER, you will change the ER ending to A. Water, so you get water. Sister, sister. Writer, writer. Paper, paper. Runner, runner. Teacher, teacher.
So given that language is constantly changing, and that, of course, includes English as well, which is in a constant state of flux, where do you see English in the next 20, 30, 50 years?
It's a million-dollar question. What's interesting with English is that because of what's been happening with it, the global status and so on, you have two different and simultaneous forces acting upon it, right? On the one hand, you have this kind of, if you like, fragmentation of English into different varieties, right? And the distinctiveness and everything. And that's just a direct consequence of the fact that it's so widespread, right? So that's normal, and that's what you'd expect, right? Yeah. The more English continues to spread around the world, the more it becomes different. And diverse. That's what I mean. But that's happening on one hand. On the other hand, you have more global forces. Let's call it globalization, just to use a shortcut. Right. So if English is used as an international language, and it is, and it's going to be used more as an international lingua franca, then you also have something that keeps it somehow together. Without legislation, without dictionaries, but almost like a physiological force that keeps it together by its use, right? So people using it internationally and as a lingua franca will keep it together. So you have at the same time this Venn diagram. If you go back to the Venn diagram idea that I was talking about before, so if each type of English is a circle, these circles are kind of pulling apart and going back together as well. So there are two forces that pull them apart. One force does that, and the other force kind of pushes them back together, because that's in the nature of a large international lingua franca as English. So that's what's happening. It won't become the only language in the world or any, there's all sorts of scenarios that sometimes people read about English. Definitely not in the next 20, 30 years, definitely not. Will it stay the main international lingua franca in the next, say, 50 years or 100 years? That's a huge question mark. There is no reason to believe that things remain the way they are. There's no reason to believe that we are at the end of history. There are big other languages. And again, if we recognize how the trajectory of a language is tied very, very strongly to matters of power and politics, depending on how power shifts around the world, that will determine the fate of languages as well.
You've been listening to English, Friend or Frenemy, from Ideas producer Naheed Mustafa. Thank you to Mario Saraceni, reader in English language and linguistics at the University of Portsmouth, field recordings by Aparita Bandari and Leonisa Reyes. Our web producer is Lisa Ayuso. Technical production, Danielle Duval. The senior producer is Nikola Lukšić. The executive producer of Ideas is Greg Kelly, and I'm Nala Ayed.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.